Chapter 7. The Assassins. When I recall my second passage through the tunnel that led to the outer world, I feel it occupied a watch or more. My nerves have never, I suppose, been fully sound, tormented as they have always been by relentless memory. Then they were keyed to the highest pitch, so that to take three strides seemed to exhaust a lifetime. I was frightened, of course. I have never been called a coward since I was a small boy, and on certain occasions, various persons have commented on my courage. I have performed my duties as a member of the guild without flinching, fought both privately and in war, climbed crags, and several times nearly drowned. But I believe there is no other difference between those who are called courageous and those who are branded craven than that the second are fearful before the danger and the first after it. No one can be much frightened, certainly during a period of great and imminent peril. The mind is too much concentrated on the thing itself, and on the actions necessary to meet or avoid it. The coward is a coward, then, because he has brought his fear with him. Persons we think cowardly will sometimes amaze us by their bravery, if they have had no forewarning of their danger. Master Gerlose, whom I had supposed to be of the most dauntless courage when I was a boy, was unquestionably a coward. During the period when Draught was captain of apprentices, Rosh and I used to alternate, turn and turn about, in serving Master Gerlose and Master Perlyman. And one night, when Master Gerlose had retired to his cabin, but instructed me to stay to fill his cup for him, he began to confide in me.
"Lad, do you know the client Aya, an armiger's daughter and quite good-looking?"
As an apprentice, I had few dealings with clients. I shook my head.
"She is to be abused."
I had no idea what he meant, so I said, "Yes, master." "That's the greatest disgrace that can befall a woman, or a man either, to be abused by the torturer." He touched his chest and threw back his head to look at me. He had a remarkably small head for so large a man. If he had worn a shirt or jacket, which of course he never did, one would have been tempted to believe it padded. "Yes, master."
"Aren't you going to offer to do it for me? A young fellow like you, full of juice? Don't tell me you're not hairy yet."
At last I understood what he meant, and I told him that I had not realized it would be permissible since I was still an apprentice, but that if he gave the order, I would certainly obey.
"I imagine you would. She's not bad, you know. But tall, and I don't like them tall. There's an exultant bastard in that family a generation or so back, you may be sure. Blood will confess itself, as they say, though only we know all that means.
Want to do it?"
He held out his cup and I poured. "If you wish me to, master."
The truth was that I was excited at the thought. I had never possessed a woman.
"You can't. I must."
"What if I were to be questioned?"
"Then, too, I must certify it. Sign the papers. A master of the guild for 20 years, and I've never falsified papers."
"I suppose you think I can't do it." The thought had never crossed my mind, just as the opposite thought, that he might still retain some potency, had never occurred to me with regard to Master Palaemon, whose white hair, stooped shoulders, and peering lens made him seem like one who had been decrepit always.
"Well, look here,"
Master Gerlose said, and heaved himself out of his chair. He was one of those who can walk well and speak clearly even when they are very drunk, and he strode over to a cabinet quite confidently, though I thought for a moment that he was going to drop the blue porcelain jar he took down.
This is a rare and potent drug.
He took the lid off and showed me a dark brown powder.
It never fails.
You'll have to use it someday, so you ought to know about it.
Just take as much as you can get under your fingernail on the end of a knife, you follow me? If you take too much, you won't be able to appear in public for a couple of days.
I said, I'll remember, Master.
Of course, it's a poison. They all are. And this is the best. A little more than that would kill you. And you mustn't take it again until the moon changes, understand?
Perhaps you'd better have Brother Corbinian weigh the dose, Master.
Corbinian was our apothecary. I was terrified that Master Gerloz might swallow a spoonful before my eyes.
Me? I don't need it.
Contemptuously, he put the lid on the jar again and banged it down on its shelf in the cabinet.
That's well, Master.
Besides, he winked at me.
I'll have this.
From his sabretache, he took an iron phallus. It was about a span and a half long and had a leather thong through the end opposite the tip.
It must seem idiotic to you who read this, but for an instant I could not imagine what the thing was for. Despite the somewhat exaggerated realism of its design, I had a wild notion that the wine had rendered him childish, as a little boy is who supposes there is no essential difference between his wooden mount and a real animal. I wanted to laugh.
Abuse. That's their word.
That, you see, is where they've left us and out.
He had slapped the iron phallus against his palm. The same gesture, now that I think of it, that the man-ape who had threatened me had made with his mace.
Then I had understood and had been gripped by revulsion. But even that revulsion was not the emotion I would feel now in the same situation. I did not sympathize with the client because I did not think of her at all. It was only a sort of repugnance for Master Gerloz, who with all his bulk and great strength was forced to rely on the brown powder, and still worse, on the iron phallus I had seen. An object that might have been sawed from a statue, and perhaps had been.
Yet I saw him on another occasion, when the thing had to be done immediately for fear the order could not otherwise be carried out before the client died, act at once and without powder or phallus and without difficulty. Master Gerloz was a coward then. Still, perhaps his cowardice was better than the courage I would have possessed in his position, for courage is not always a virtue. I had been courageous, as such things are counted, when I had fought the man-apes, but my courage was no more than a mixture of foolhardiness, surprise, and desperation. Now, in the tunnel, when there was no longer any cause for fear, I was afraid and nearly dashed my brains out against the low ceiling. But I did not pause or even slacken speed before I saw the opening before me, made visible by the blessed sheen of moonlight. Then indeed I halted, and considering myself safe, wiped my sword as well as I might with the ragged edge of my cloak and sheathed her. That done, I slung her over my shoulder and swung myself out and down, feeling with the toes of my sodden boots for the ledges that had supported me in the ascent. I had just gained the third when two quarrels struck the rock near my head. One must have wedged its point in some flaw in the ancient work, for it remained in place, blazing with white fire. I recall how astonished I was, and also how I hoped, in the few moments before the next struck nearer still and nearly blinded me, that the arbalists were not of the kind that bring a new projectile to the string when cocked, and thus are so swift to shoot again. When the third exploded against the stone, I knew they were. And I dropped before the marksman who had missed could fire yet again. There was, and I ought to have known there would be, a deep pool where the stream fell down from the mouth of the mine. I got another ducking, but since I was already wet, it did no harm, and in fact quenched the flecks of fire that had clung to my face and arms. There could be no question here of cannily remaining below the surface. The water seized me as if I were a stick and flung me to the top where it willed. This, by the greatest good luck, was some distance from the rock face, and I was able to watch my attackers from behind as I clambered onto the bank. They and the woman who stood between them were staring at the place where the cascade fell. As I drew Terminus Est for the final time that night, I called, "Over here, Agia." I had guessed earlier that it was she. But as she turned, more swiftly than either of the men with her, I glimpsed her face in the moonlight. It was a terrible face to me, though for all her self-depreciation so lovely, because the sight of it meant that Thecla was surely dead. The man nearest me was fool enough to try to bring his arbalest to his shoulder before he pulled the trigger. I ducked and cut his legs from under him, while the other's quarrel whizzed over my head like a meteor. By the time I had straightened up again, the second man had dropped his arbalest and was drawing his hanger. Agio was quicker, making a cut at my neck with an athame before his weapon was free of the scabbard. I dodged her first stroke and parried her second, though Terminus Est's blade was not made for fencing. My own attack made her bound back. "Get behind him," she called to the second arbalisteer. "I can front him." He did not answer. Instead, his mouth swung open and his point swung wide. Before I realized that it was not at me that he was looking, something feverishly gleaming bounded past me. I heard the ugly sound of a breaking skull. Agia turned as gracefully as any cat and would have spitted the man-ape, but I struck the poisoned blade from her hand and sent it skittering into the pool. She tried to flee then. I caught her by the hair and jerked her off her feet. The man-ape was mumbling over the body of the arbalisteer he had killed. Whether he sought to loot it, or was merely curious about its appearance, I have never known. I set my foot on Agia's neck, and the man-ape straightened and turned to face me, then dropped in the crouching posture I had seen in the mine, and held up his arms. One hand was gone. I recognized the clean cut of Terminus Est. The man-ape mumbled something I could not understand. I tried to reply. "Yes, I did that. I'm sorry. We are at peace now." The beseeching look remained, and he spoke again. Blood still seeped from the stump, though his kind must possess a mechanism for pinching shut the veins, as thylacodons are said to do. Without the attentions of a surgeon, a man would have bled to death from that wound. "I cut it," I said. "But it was while we were still fighting, before you people saw the claw of the conciliator." Then it came to me that he must have followed me outside for another glimpse of the gem, braving the fear engendered by whatever we had waked below the hill. I thrust my hand into the top of my boot and pulled out the claw. And the instant I had done so, realized what a fool I had been to put the boot and its precious cargo so close to Agia's reach. For her eyes went wide with cupidity at the moment that the man-ape abased himself further and stretched forth his piteous stump. For a moment we were posed, all three, and a strange group we must have looked in that eerie light. An astonished voice, Jonas's, called Severian from the heights above. Like the trumpet note in a shadow play that dissolves all feigning. That shout ended our tableau. I lowered the claw and concealed it in my palm. The man-ape bolted for the rock face, and Agia began to struggle and curse beneath my foot. A rap with the flat of my blade quieted her, but I kept my boot on her until Jonas had joined me, and there were two of us to prevent her escape. I thought you might need help, he said. I perceive I was mistaken. He was looking at the corpses of the men who had been with Agia. I said, this wasn't the real fight. Agia was sitting up, rubbing her neck and shoulders.
There were four, and we would have had you. But the bodies of those things, those firefly tiger men, started pitching out of the hole, and two were afraid and slipped away.
Jonas scratched his head with a steel hand, a sound like the currying of a charger.
I saw what I thought I saw then. I had begun to wonder.
I asked what he thought he had seen.
A glowing being in a fur robe making an obeisance to you? You were holding up a cup of burning brandy, I think. Or was it incense? What's this?
He bent and picked up something from the edge of the bank, where the man-ape had crouched. A bludgeon.
Yes, I see that.
There was a loop of sinew at the end of the bone handle, and Jonas slipped it over his wrist.
Who are these people who tried to kill you?
We would have, Agia said, if it hadn't been for that cloak. We saw him coming out of the hole, but it covered him when he started to climb down, and my men couldn't see the target. Only the skin of his arms.
I explained, as briefly as I could, how I had become involved with Agia and her twin, and described the death of Agilis.
So now she's come to join him.
Jonas looked from her to the crimson length of Terminus Est, and gave a little shrug.
I left my Merrick hip up there, and perhaps I ought to go and look after her. That way, I could say afterward that I saw nothing. Was this woman the one who sent the letter?
I should have known.
I had told her about Thecla.
You don't know about Thecla, but she did. And that was what the letter was about. I told her while we were going through the botanic gardens in Nessus. There were mistakes in the letter and things Thecla would never have said. But I didn't stop to think of them when I read it.
I stepped away and replaced the claw in my boot, thrusting it deep.
Maybe you had better attend to your animal, as you say. My own seems to have broken loose, and we may have to take turns riding yours.
Jonas nodded and began to climb back the way he had come.
You were waiting for me, weren't you?
I asked Agia.
I heard something, and the destrier cocked his ears at the sound. That was you. Why didn't you kill me then?
We were up there. She gestured toward the heights.
And I wanted the men I'd hired to shoot you when you came wading up the brook. They were stupid and stubborn, as men always are, and said they wouldn't waste their quarrels, that the creatures inside would kill you. I rolled down a stone, the biggest I could move, but by then it was too late.
They had told you about the mine? Agia shrugged, and the moonlight turned her bare shoulders to something more precious and more beautiful than flesh.
You're going to kill me now, so what does it matter? All the local people tell stories about this place. They say those things come out at night during storms and take animals from the cowsheds, and sometimes break into the houses for children. There's also a legend that they guard treasure inside. So I put that in the letter, too. I thought if you wouldn't come for your Thekla, you might come for that. Can I stand with my back to you, Severian? If it's all the same, I don't want to see it coming. When she said that, I felt as though a weight had been lifted from my heart. I had not been certain I could strike her, if I had to look into her face. I raised my own iron phallus, and as I did so felt there was one more thing I wanted to ask Agia, but I could not recall what it might be. "Strike," she said. "I am ready." I sought good footing, and my fingers found the woman's head at one end of the guard, the head that marked the female edge. And, a little later again, "Strike!" But by that time, I had climbed out of the veil.